trying to see all my stuff here.
Good job.
Today we're going to have public hearing on House Bill 5031, and we'd like for the introduction of the bill or comments to come from the speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. We're continuing the hearings on the children, adults, and families portion of House Bill 5031. The self-sufficiency program is continuing today, and the plan is to wrap up the agency presentation on those programs today, and then there will be public testimony tomorrow.
Okay, members, as I'd asked you yesterday, because we did go over and listen to public testimony yesterday, what I'd like to do, because they have such a short window of time to make their presentation, I'd like for that to happen today, and if at the close you can write questions down, but if it's burning, I encourage that to be asked. Thank you, Ms. Ramona.
Thank you, Chair Carter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ramona Foley. I'm Assistant Director at DHS with an area called Children, Adults, and Families. And we will pick back up today where we left off yesterday and finish on the jobs. Okay, so Vic.
Chair Carter, members of the committee. Vic Todd, Administrator for the Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs. And where I'm going to start today is on essentially page 35. Due to the numbers of programs that we do want to cover, I am going to move fairly quickly and briefly, and just want to say to start that we are more than happy to meet with you separately, individually, and so forth. So more than happy to go through any of these programs with more time. I'm going to start and just talk about jobs a little bit. I think we have touched on that quite a bit, actually, in terms of what we do in the jobs program. It's an integral part of the total TANF program. In the past few days, we've talked about both the structure changes and the partnerships, and so I think that really touched on it pretty well. We serve about 11,000 people a month in that program, and the one issue that I do want to point out in here is on page 37, and that's talking about the participation rates. We've talked about that in the last few days, but to give a perspective, without that caseload reduction credit that I described on Monday, Oregon's fiscal 06 participation rate achieved was at 16.2% for the all-family rate and 22.5% for the two-parent. So that's just in context in terms of some of the federal requirements and where we need to get to. Also, briefly, just wanted to talk a little bit more about Jobs Plus in terms of what that program component is and the numbers of people that are served. And that essentially is a subsidized work program for individuals that are on TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And currently we serve about 110 clients a month in that program. It essentially is that we work with employers. The employer provides a mentoring relationship. The client actually gets a check that is based upon their TANF and food stamp allotment, plus a weight supplement if necessary at this point. So with that, I'll just stop with that. And if you want additional information, we'd be happy to provide it.
Burning questions? We can feel free to burn any questions if you have any. Okay.
The policy package really that affects jobs is the TANF reauthorization policy package that we talked about on Monday, or Tuesday, I guess, actually. So I'm going to move to the domestic violence program. This program is a subset of the overall TANF program, and as such, it provides support for parents that are fleeing abusive relationships and helps them to establish a new living arrangement. Victims can receive up to $1,200 in a 90-day period, and they are also eligible to get a second payment. However, there's a very small number that actually do that, and it's about 4% of the total that we serve. And we serve about 550 families a month, or roughly slightly over 5,000 a year. Again, with this particular program, we have talked about the policy packages that affect it, and those are really the 101-9 and 101-17, which are the caseload cost per case adjustment and inflation backfill.
So what's different this time in this policy package that you did not do during, say, the last 2 years of that session?
Essentially, Chair Carter, the issue is in terms of when the projections are done for this particular program, and not just for the domestic violence, but in terms of those policy packages, this program is budgetarily not treated as a mandatory program. And so it's the department then comes back and makes a policy proposal to include those caseload forecast changes and or inflationary adjustments if there is a revenue shortfall.
So will it affect the relationship in terms of partnerships with deliverers of domestic violence services in the community?
Chair Carter, I think it helps from the standpoint that with this inflationary increase, it helps ensure that providers will continue to participate in this program. And so it does help from a resource standpoint.
So 501(c)s and counties are not affected in their domestic violence programs that are ongoing right now?
Chair Carter, I'm not sure I can
answer. They're not affected in the sense that the delivery of services will be any different than what they are in right now. Or they'll be better, is that what I'm hearing you saying? As a result of more resources.
Chair Carter, yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's...
I just want you to say that. I think that's good stuff that you might want to have on record.
Yes. Yeah, no, we are pleased that that these packages are being filled.
Okay.
Yes.
Great.
With that, we move to ERDC, the Employment-Related Daycare Program.
Madam Chair.
Excuse me for a minute. Representative Cote?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. You talked about TADVS as not being mandatory. If I just want to recall for the group, that's because it's not statutorily required, and so therefore, I mean, we had this big discussion when we were having the special sessions and the budget cuts that this wasn't a mandatory program. And can you just clarify that for the group?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, I think it really stems from when the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program was created, and the federal level it was created as a block grant program, whereas when it was the Aid to Families for Dependent Children program, it was a matched program, and it was viewed as a mandatory program at that point. When it changed to a block grant program, for state budgeting purposes, it was redefined to be a non-mandatory program. So unlike food stamps, where you have a projected growth, for example, in that caseload, and that would be funded, and the benefits, of course, are 100% federal funds, but the administrative costs are not, those needs would be funded as part of the base development. Whereas with non-mandatories, that's not necessarily true.
But we as a legislature could determine that we would want to serve every domestic violence person who came in the door. We could make it a state entitlement, basically, if we wanted to. Is that correct?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, that is correct. You can make those decisions.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm sure that, as a matter of record as well, I'm sure that you will continue to be steadfast in that arena in terms of taking care of those who have been victims of domestic violence.
Chair Carter, most certainly that is our intent.
Thank you very much. Would you hold for just a moment? I want to welcome SEIU people who are in the audience with us today, and thank you for coming.
At this point, I'm moving to page 47, which is the beginning of the employment-related daycare program.
Well, members, I want you to take a good look at this because there has been an increase of $34.5 million
in this program. So if you have any questions in terms of how different this will be in terms of the additional amount of dollars in this program, what the deliverables will be, is it any differently than the last time? So I just want to bring that to you. Thanks.
Again, I'm going to do a fairly brief summary and then talk about a few things that relate to ultimately what the policy package is attempting to do. Employment-related daycare program is really a program that's designed to help low-income working families be able to afford quality child care. And currently, there are about 9,500 families that receive those services, and that affects about 20,000 children. The current eligibility threshold is set at 150% of the federal poverty level. That was reduced in 2003 from the 185% level that had been at previously. For the program, the average copay, which is the amount that the family is required to pay to the provider, is about $134 a month. And the average cost per case for the department in terms of what we pay to the providers is about $386 a month. The payments are made directly to the provider in terms of the payment the portion of the payment that is DHS's, and then the client is responsible to pay the provider their share. Providers are screened both for criminal background and for child protective services. I wanted to turn to page 49 and talk a little bit about some of the comparisons. Again, this will, I think, help in the discussion around the policy package. And at the bottom of page 49, there's a table there that lays out is really the first of two charts I want to talk about, and that first chart lays out for several states what their income threshold is, and then the last two columns look at what the copayment would be at various two different federal poverty level income levels. And so what you can see is that at 100% Oregon's copay for a family would be $141, and essentially at 150%, it would be $517, but essentially the client would not be eligible. On the next page,
excuse me. So does this mean that in terms of a copayment, that the poverty level increases from 150 to something else? What's the next something else number is?
Chair Carter, at 150% or 151%, the client would not be eligible.
Okay.
And so that's where the eligibility would end. So what it really demonstrates is a rapid ramp up in terms of that copay cost for the client.
So we're not adding numbers of people who beyond 150%. So I'm trying to figure out, since we have such a large increase, are we serving more people that raising our numbers at the bottom as opposed to raising the top levels of help to
Chair Carter, the change that occurs in terms of the copay is an overall average of 20%, but it will affect different portions of that stream in different ways.
Thank you. Ms. Baker?
Madam Chair, if I could clarify, though, I think what this chart portrays is just the current program. If you look at the policy option package, then yes, you would have another column that showed a copayment for people up to 185% of the poverty level, because there is an expansion in the package.
Okay.
But this just shows you what's happening with the current program.
Okay. Thank you.
Page 50, the chart on that page is really showing the reimbursement levels. And what you can see is that Oregon this is for a center care for a four-year-old in a metropolitan area. And Oregon's is at $398. And you can see what the other states are, reflect. The column on the right-hand side is really a reflection of the child care development fund requirements. Well, I shouldn't say requirements, because it's actually a recommended threshold that states should pay at. And this is one of those descriptions that probably gets a little confusing at times, because it's referred to as the 75th percentile. And what that means is that you would pay essentially 100% of what a provider would charge for 75% of the market, so that there are groups of providers who actually charge more than that 75th percentile rate, where you would not pay that much. And so this is really just giving you a kind of a bird's eye perspective of how Oregon compares to that 75th percentile, and currently we're at about the 26th percentile in terms of the market level. At this point, I think then we would move to the policy package to come to describe what's going on in that policy package, address some of these issues. So on page 53, 101-1, child care improvements. This policy package is trying to address three issues. The first issue being increasing the eligibility threshold from 150% to 185% of the federal poverty level guidelines. Secondly, it is looking to reduce the average copay by 20%. And lastly, it's looking to increase the subsidy paid to the providers to approximately the 75th percentile of the 2006 market rate. So that package then has a general fund cost of $34.9 million. As there's no federal funds to accompany that, there are none. So the total fund is the same as the general.
Representative Cortez. Thank you. I think it would, first of all, it's wonderful to see these new investments being proposed. We've had some of the highest copays and lowest reimbursements in the country. I think the National Women's Law Project report that you referred to will actually show us how we compare to 50 states, and we've been very low for many years. It would be helpful to see the tables you prepared for the current program based on what the policy option is, where the copays would be, referring back to the tables you were looking at, if for the new proposal. That would be helpful, I think, to show where we are now and where we're going to be. That would be great. Thank you.
Because actually, members, we have the lowest interest in terms of reimbursement.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette.
Okay, the policy, the package includes $34.9 million. What is the current amount that we're spending on the copays?
Chair Carter, Senator Morissette, I don't have offhand what we're currently paying.
Well, how much more money, I'm sorry, may I?
Senator Morissette.
How much of an increase is the governor's budget over what it was, or over what it currently is?
Chair Carter, Senator Morissette, I can get you that. I don't know right off the top of my head what the percentage change is, but I can get that for you.
This paper will come up. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I missed part of the question, but if you're looking for the overall amount in the employment-related daycare program, I think it's around $90 million, give or take $5 million, either way. And so this is about a little over a 30% increase in the funding overall.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Nathanson and Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this policy option package, 101-1, about how much of this there are really two different concepts folded into one package. How much is for the subsidy part and how much for the income limit? Increasing the limit.
Representative Nathanson, there are actually three pieces in terms of the increasing the eligibility threshold to 185% is estimated to cost about $1.9 million. The copay decrease is estimated to cost about $6.5 million. and the subsidy increase about 26.1 million. The additional 400,000 is related to staffing changes as a result of an estimated caseload growth of about 742.
Thank you.
And Chair, in response to Representative Kotek's question, we'll provide that. And an example of the 150% level that would drop from the 517 to about 310.
Okay. Thank you.
Something's come up that I have a question about in relation to my Joint Committee on Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy, and we have a bill that we've been looking at, and it's been being vetted, and it's to provide an evacuation program or plan or whatever, if you will, for all care of elder people, younger people in all capacities. And my question is, am I right that some of these providers are not licensed?
Chair Carter, Vice Chair Boone, that's correct.
So the question would be, if they're not licensed, what sort of oversight is there, and how can we make sure that if they're required to provide an evacuation plan and relocation plan in the case of an emergency, if we don't have any way of any kind of oversight or tracking in that sense?
Chair Carter, Vice Chair Boone, I'm calling in reinforcements.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Anderson. I'm the Employment Relief Daycare Program Manager. That specific bill, I know, exempts, I think, unlicensed facilities. We require, as one of the requirements for a person to participate in the subsidy program, that they do have an evacuation plan. Okay. It's mirrored on the child care division rules.
Okay. They have them in.
Other than complaints, or what we depend a lot on parents to make sure that providers are complying with the requirements that we set out for them, but we don't have people that can go out and inspect homes as they do with child care division licenses.
And discussions with fire marshal's office, how do they connect with this so that they might know at the local level? The hope is that the plans would be able to be at least tracked for, and we're considering these vulnerable populations because they need assistance. And so how would the fire service, for example, in the case of a tsunami or a flood or an earthquake or some emergency event, be able to know where to go to get these little kids out?
That's a good question. There's no mechanism in place. We certainly could make that available because we do have the record, of course, of where the providers are located. Typically, exempt providers care for very few. Well, by law, they can only care for three or fewer children. Licensed providers can care for up. Family providers can care for up to 10. So there aren't great numbers of children, and typically are cared for, they're very often friends and relatives that are informal providers that are caring for children in exempt situations.
Okay, that's just a final comment. Then that's the kind of information that's helpful to us to know, and in our final report, we'll probably be asking you then to impart to the unlicensed people or people who are not being able to be tracked to please connect with their local emergency responders so that they might know. And it's an easy phone call and say, we're here, we have these many kids, this is what our floor plan looks like, and to connect, because that's what we're looking for, community connectedness in evacuation plans.
Chair Carter, Representative Brunette, that would be great. We would be more than happy to participate.
Chair Carter, and Representative, if I may, just one comment. When Dr. Susan Allen comes before the committee on the public health
piece she will be talking about probably the emergency preparedness, because there is an agency-wide effort to identify who the populations are. I can't remember what the deadline is for when we have to have that done, but they're looking across all vulnerable populations to see how we're going to work with the counties to make sure those plans are in place. So that'll be something we'll take back to her to make sure she's able to include that in her testimony.
Okay. Ms. Foley, I want to tell you why that is important. In New Orleans, I have, Lisa has a sister who is keeping state kids.
Mm-hmm.
I had to send them money, emergency money, through a bank, and they ended up in Georgia. The state is now just getting a handle on where all the kids are. And there is no way for them to contact the state to give them money to leave in that emergency situation. And I had to send them money through a friend of mine who is a bank president in Georgia for them to have money to put these kids in a hotel until they can get money. These are very important questions that are being asked here today. And I'd like to have some kind of strategy that the state is going to use, as you said, when the doctor comes, the public health come before us. That is an absolute imperative that we have that, because we might not be so lucky that somebody has somebody in another place that they have had kids that belong to the state, and the state has no means of knowing where the kids are, whether they've been rescued, or whether they're in safe harbor. And so thank you for bringing those questions, Representative Boone, because that is exactly the case that happened in New Orleans.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Dr. Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm sorry I had to step out. I had a Valentine's Day medical emergency heaped upon me. If I didn't take care of something, I was going to end up in the emergency room. So hope you excuse me. If this question has been asked already, I want to apologize. My memory of this program is that in the past we've been told by several studies that the most important thing we can do for families in poverty is give them daycare for the children. Most of the families involved are usually single women who are raising children, and what they need more than anything else is quality daycare for the children. And I want that question answered first, if that's still true. The second thing I want to answer it is, according to our full analysis, Oregon ranks last nationally for low-income working families' access to the child care market. I want that as a true statement also. And if so, what will this enhancement package do as far as really opening up child care to low-income families? This is about self-sufficiency, moving people out of poverty. And this is the most important program we have. If that's true, how are we managing ourselves in the position that we are last in the nation? This seems to me almost like the problem we have with food 3 or 4 years ago, where we were number one in the nation as far as hunger was concerned, and now we're facing a situation where we seem to be accessing ourselves to become number one as far as poverty is concerned.
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, I think the answer to your first two questions is absolutely yes. I think there's more information now than there was several years ago in terms of the importance of quality child care and child care that has more of an educational element to it. So this package helps to bring us back to being able to enable low-income working families to be able to afford that type of child care. And I think in terms of trying to answer the question, how did we get to where we are, I think a lot of it has to do with the budgetary issues we've had in the last several biennials, and where those difficulties led us in terms of not having increases in that percentile of market level that we've paid has eroded.
A couple points. One, if this is the best program we have for lifting people out of poverty, we should be told that over and over again. This is the best program we have. This should be our highest priority for self-sufficiency. I haven't heard that, but maybe I was out of the room, and if I did, I apologize. Okay. Second question is, how many more families can we serve with this package? How much are we going to expand the program as far as access is concerned? You may not be able to give me that number today, but I'd like to have it at a later time. Where we're at now, where we're going to move to with this enhancement of this package.
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, the estimated increase in the number of cases is 742. I think part of this is it's a restoration in a lot of ways in terms of what was done in earlier, you know, 3-4 years ago.
That's why we stole money.
So what?
We stole the money. We took the money from child care and put it into other services.
Well, it's important where we stole the money from. That's on the point I'm trying to get here. And I'm afraid we may have stolen the money from a lot of places we shouldn't have. But this may have been ones we should have said we really made a mistake stealing the money from. If this is the number one way of getting people out of poverty, getting them back to work, so they can support their families, pay taxes, make the system work, why did we cut this program to the point that we are last in the nation? That's my question.
What you don't want to say, you have to ask the co-chairs in the legislature about that.
Chair Carter, you're correct. I would not want to say that.
Well, Madam Chair, I do want to say that. I want to say, Senator Bates asked the question, mm-hmm. Why are we last in the nation? We can ask that question with regard to our children in a number of different categories. We're last because the legislature has failed to invest. The legislature has failed to make this make children the highest priority. That is why we are last. And it has, and it's not just focused on decisions that were made in the last few biennium. An example that comes to my mind of our failure to raise children to the highest priority is Head Start. That's in another committee. I know that, Madam Chair and colleagues, but you know, the legislature at another time in the 80s said that children, and especially the poorest of the poor children, were going to be the priority. And a program, Head Start, was created. And that was going to be where we placed the investment in the 80s. And the promise made at that time in the 80s by the legislature of that time was that we were going to take care of the poorest of the poor children. Well, there has been a failure to keep that promise session after session after session after session after session after session after session. And so here we are wondering why we're last. Well, the answer is simple. And so it's... Again, we have in front of us opportunity, and it comes down to how we will face the opportunity and where we will place the investments of the dollars that are available, also recognizing that the dollars that are available are unsustainable dollars and that we still will need to face the issue and problem of having a revenue gathering system that provides enough revenue to make the investments that we should make, need to make, in our children and in the future of our state. So that's my speech for February 14th on Oregon's birthday, and I just feel compelled to make it given the question that Senator Bates.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Kotek had her hand up.
Oh, go ahead. Okay,
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Thank you. Of the different parts of this policy option package, I'm interested in pursuing for a moment the part about copay. If the goal is to provide increased access to quality daycare, there are two parts to that. There's the quality part and reimbursement for providers, and there's access, which is who has access to daycare. Copay satisfies the second part of that, the access to daycare. So right now, in this package, the intent is to lower the average copay by 20%. And you indicated that was 700 and some odd clients additional would be covered. You can correct me if I got that number wrong. If the copay were reduced by 30% or 50%, what kind of impact would that have?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, we can develop estimates around that. The 742 cases is the total estimate of increased numbers of families that would come to this program as a result of that combined, those three items combined. And so, but we can get you some estimates in terms of other alternative approaches.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the challenges to rebuilding our program is building a strong enough program. We've made policy choices in the state not to have a waiting list. And so what we've done is we've watered down the program in terms of the reimbursements and the copays. And unfortunately, at this stage, I would like to see us add more children, but that's increasing the income eligibility. But what we need to do now is to strengthen the program. We have a very non-functioning program in terms of access and reimbursements and things like that. Hopefully next biennium we can talk, because we have other states in this country that have, their income eligibility is 350% of the poverty level. They're serving a lot of working poor families. We're not at that stage yet because our program needs some strengthening in terms of what it pays and what parents pay. So to give you a sense of why I think the proposal is this way, because we've let things kind of, the quality has decreased in the program, to be very honest. And parents cycle in and out of the program because we haven't had good reimbursement rates. We haven't had, you know, our copays have been too high. We have to fix that.
This is also a two-way street. Do you know that at BET, 99.75% of the child care providers are women? And so it becomes a dual situation in terms of poverty, because we lowered the amount that we were paying these people, and those women that are keeping the children are also heads of household in most instances. So by funding this program at a higher level and showing our support for investment in low-income people to, you know, get into the marketplace and to be able to lift themselves up, we help both the provider as well as those that are seeking those provisions. And so that is really important for us to keep before us. And that's one of the reasons we are seeking to change this program into OSAC, that hopefully that it won't be so easy for us to go back and take the money from DHS when it's in OSAC, because they really do know the people that better than maybe DHS would, because those guys are seeking access to higher education and sometimes just to your programs. So it's very important that we look at this piece very carefully. Further questions?
Chair Carter, if I may, I would like to clarify what we mean by access. Access does certainly have to do with copay, but it also has a lot to do with provider reimbursement rates. And effectively what happens is when you're at the 26th percentile, that means that only 26% of the providers out there in the formal market will pay at our rates or below. And what that means for parents who are trying to find quality child care is they can't afford to pay for it. In addition to a high copay, mm-hmm. there's a huge gap between what we pay and what providers usually charge. Therefore, we lose access to that market, and that's what we mean by access.
Thank you.
Chair Carter, just one other comment, because I think one of the other important elements to this is that while we pay, you know, a payment to the provider, and there's the copay, and then the piece that Mark mentioned in terms of that differential the client has to make up, they also have activity fees, enrollment fees, you know, that are upfront costs for the client that we don't pay for. So that there are lots of challenges for low-income working families in terms of securing your child care.
Wow. Ms. Kotek?
Very quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it's important to remember that these changes and how they will interact with the TANF program, the TANF redesign, because if we're looking to help families stay working, we have to have the child care resources to support them. So these are very integrated package proposals connected with what we talked about yesterday.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, that's true. That's a good observation. You ready to move to the next?
Okay.
Madam Chair, just to say again in another way before we leave this area, because it is so critical, you know, we invest in what we value, in what we value. And we do not value children. We talk about them. We talk about their needs, yes, but we're not a country, and we are not yet a state that values children. If we did, the conversation that we've been having would be unnecessary. I say this because I hope the co-chairs pay attention to this critical need and its place in the final budget. And I know that you'll pass on that message.
I will. I will, Senator. Thank you. You're always trying to get me in trouble. Go on.
The next policy package, 101-1.5, is the transfer of the student child care program from the Department of Human Services to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And this is really to improve access for students and make it more readily apparent to them that this option is there. And so that would reduce the children's, adults, and families budget by $900,000 with that transfer. With that, we could move to food stamps, unless there.
One question, too. The other day, I was asking the speaker this question. She said it was nice to ask the department, and that is, what kind of performance measures are you expecting from OSAC around this particular issue on policy package 101-1? That is going to be an imperative.
Chair Carter, we can talk with OSAC about that in terms of their performance measure expectations. Offhand, I don't know what the...
Right, because we don't want to pass it off and have them thinking that we are not expecting certain performances to be met. And so we want to make sure that that is very, very clear along those lines.
Chair Carter, we'll get you some feedback on that.
Okay. Ms. Baker, anything else you'd like to say on this, please?
Madam Chair, I think one of the things that the co-chairs have been interested in hearing, particularly on policy packages that are significant, is how that would affect what the agency is currently tracking in terms of key performance measures or other outcomes. And it may be that it would be worthwhile to spend a little bit of time, in addition to the discussion about the transfer to OSAC on the child care student daycare program, but also on the almost $35 million in child care improvements, in addition to number of additional families served, what other things will the department be tracking to make sure that that is having the impact that one hopes that it would?
Exactly. And especially when you start talking about the increase in dollar amounts to the providers of child care, that would be very, very important. Ms. Jensen.
Chair Carter, our key performance measure for child care measures the percentage of providers who provide care to subsidy children who delivered an enhanced level of care because of that training. And for the most part, it's the same training that child care division requires of registered family providers. Basic health and safety training, first aid, CPR, reporting and recognizing child abuse, food handlers certificate. That measure is useful only for so far, because what it doesn't really measure and what we really want to see an improvement in is the number of children, the percentage of children who receive an enhanced level of care. And one way to measure that would be to use what the Child Care Bureau is proposing, which is percentage of children who are served in licensed care.
Okay.
And currently in Oregon, 38% of our children are in licensed care, 62% are in exempt care. The subsidy population.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the worst in the nation on that one. There are a couple of states, and I don't remember, a couple of years ago I saw some figures, and there are a couple of states that are a little higher than that. I think they had about 65% of the children were in exempt care. But we're one of the highest numbers and percentages in the nation. And that's where we would really hope to see an improvement, because what this is doing is opening up licensed care. care as an option to families who receive the subsidy.
Ms. Kotel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just throw out the caveat that licensed care doesn't always mean quality care, so I think we should be careful with that. But I would like to see a new key performance measure showing, following up on what Ms. Baker said. One of the things that hopefully we'll achieve with these new investments is we will not see the cycling of families. I would like, can we measure the stability to the child of not having to change a provider because they couldn't afford the copay, they couldn't, paying providers enough? This should fix some of that. So can we somehow track how often are kids staying in the same provider in the program for a longer period of time instead of cycling off every 3 to 6 months? That might be a possible
performance measure. That's a very important measure to think about. I was just visiting the Human Services Department in Nevada, and they are at a crisis right now in terms of funding child care for their low-income parents. And so it would be interesting to know the stability that we're having. And so can we ask you to work with Ms. Anderson and bring some performance measures and you bring those back to us?
I would love to. I mean, another follow-up on that is some states actually track how many providers will take children with the public subsidy.
Okay. So can
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, on both counts, Bobby Weber, a professor at Oregon State University, has done research on stability in child care, and what it looks at is how long children are in a subsidy spell, how often they go in and out of the subsidy, which implies that they are also going in and out of different provider situations. And we can track that, and that would be something that we would hope would have this policy outcome package would have an impact.
Because we cannot fix the problem if we don't really know the whys of that. So, Ms. Foley, I would appreciate that. Representative Kotek will work with you folks on developing the performance measure.
Thank you, Chair Collins. Excellent suggestion.
Thank you. Senator Morissette.
Did I hear you correctly in saying that the unlicensed care faces do not have the safety training? Are there any requirements for an unlicensed subsidized child care in terms of training?
Chair Carter, Senator Morissette, there are no requirements.
There are no requirements.
The purpose of the enhanced rate is to encourage training, but we have not required it. We require that they meet standards, but they are basically self-certified standards. We use the same standards in general that the child care division does for the facility, health and safety requirements, but they are self-certified. Chair Carter, excuse me, but I do want to emphasize, along with Representative Kotek, that there are some exempt provider situations that are great. Sometimes it's the best option for a family. We're not in any way saying that exempt care is necessarily inferior. Sometimes it's the very best for a family. It meets a need that sometimes licensed providers can't meet.
But I do remember that once before we were talking about basically extended member family, neighbors, and people that people tend to trust as to why that is an exempt system. So I personally know that. So we certainly don't want to confuse the notion because it's exempt care that is not quality care. Right. So I hear you quite well, and we let the record make sure it's there. So Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's that last point that you were just raising that I'm very interested in. I hope that my colleague, Representative Kotek, can include this in some of her discussions about performance measures. I hope we don't set up a measurement structure that somehow encourages our communities or our agencies to push people into only the licensed and larger facilities, because the licensing has to do, and it's very sensible rationale, more than 3 children, then you have to go into this other system of being licensed and so forth. However, for all the reasons you stated, it may just be not feasible or much less desirable in some communities opportunities for one reason or another, if we've set up a situation where a child has to be taken out of the neighborhood to some very unfamiliar neighborhood, an unfamiliar setting, which turns out to be not necessarily in the best interest of that child or that mother, for example, but somehow in our performance measures, because we're tracking certain things, it makes it look like it's preferred to send kids into that situation. It has to do with what reaching certain goals or targets does to make you try to do that.
Thank you, Representative. That is well, well stated. Further comments?
Chair Carter, I'd just make one final comment on this, and that is that Oregon Benchmarks has a goal of child care costs being only 10% of a family's income. And so this package helps to move us towards that. At the lower copay levels, it tends to meet that goal, but it rapidly moves away from that as you move up to the higher copay levels. So it's good from that standpoint as well.
Thank you.
So on page 55 is where the food stamp program area begins. And again, this food stamp program...
Excuse me. Thank you, SEIU, for being with us today. Okay.
The food stamp program is a supplemental food program. It's often not looked at that way, but from the federal standpoint, it is viewed as a supplement program as opposed to providing that resource in full. The benefits that are provided are funded 100% federal funds, and in Oregon, we spend about $500 million a year in food stamp benefits, roughly $40 million a month. As of November of 2006, we were serving 428,000 people in total. That's inclusive of both the people served by children, adults, and families, as well as the seniors and people with disabilities division. In 2005, Oregon was ranked number one in terms of participation, and that's fairly significant given where we were several years ago in terms of ranking around being the hungriest state. We have moved away from that notation. The Food and Nutrition Service makes note that for every $5 of food stamp activity in a state, there's an additional or a total of $9 in economic activity generated. So there are multiple benefits from this program. I wanted to go to page 57, talk about an outcome measure. There are several pages in here where we are doing comparisons to other states, but I'll let you look at those at your leisure. This measure, page 57, is a measure I wanted to talk about because it's important in several ways, and it relates to one of the policy packages that we'll talk about when we get into the section of medical eligibility. This measure, the accuracy in determining eligibility for benefits, looks at the quality control rate, which is required. The quality control process is required by the Food and Nutrition Service. It's one of the few programs that actually has such a stringent QC process at this point, although other programs are moving in that direction. Since 1997, the food stamp caseload in Oregon has doubled, and that's been the result of a lot of efforts to increase participation in this state, and so that's well worth noting. The issue that I really want to point out, having said that, is that the error rate in Oregon has dropped from about 14% to about 5.1% as of 2006.
And I want to give kudos to the department for that, because that has been somewhat of a long-standing problem, and for that to be a totally federally funded program, but for the administration to be run by us as a state, I want to applaud you for working so diligently on this and getting your error rate down. And what that means, members, is that we don't have to pay the federal government back as a result of so many errors that we made in our program. So that means that we should not be being sanctioned for any errors, and that's really great. So kudos.
Thank you, Chair Carter, and I appreciate those comments. In fact, this is the first time in 10 years we have not been in a penalty situation. So it is significant. With that, I was going to move to the medical eligibility.
I want to go back to key performance measure number 10, the ratio of Oregonians receiving food stamps to the estimated number of Oregonians living at or below the poverty level. Has that increased or decreased in terms of your numbers? I'm looking at the graph here. Tell me what that means.
Chair Carter, on page 56, that chart is the key performance 10, and it is increasing. However, we want to look at that as we are looking at some of the other key performance measures in terms of the eligibility piece has changed from the standpoint of there is what's referred to as a categorical eligibility, that actually the eligibility goes up to 185% of poverty for certain groups, and for the general groups that are not eligible for that categorical status, it's 130% of poverty. So we want to look at other measures in terms of making it more connected to those absolute thresholds in terms of the population ratio. This comparing it to 100% of poverty is a way to look at it, but we're not sure that really does give you a good picture.
Well, it wouldn't be a good picture because I want to know how many that you actually serve. And it would appear to me that's a performance measure that you'd want to see, too, because it deals with, number one, your error rate coming down and the actual number of people that you're serving. And when you ask for more money in terms of caseloads, caseworkers, and food, I mean, in this arena, it lets the legislature know you need these people because the number of people that are being served is increasing.
Chair Carter, that's correct. And it's really that participation issue.
Right.
And, you know, how do we keep that at a high threshold and or increase it? Exactly.
And, Chair Carter, on page 57, that's back to that same chart that showed the drop in the error rate. That also shows that increase in caseload. So we can measure both of those things with comparison.
That's right. Thank you.
On page 65 is the section on medical eligibility. The Children's, Adults, and Family Self-Sufficiency Program Areas is responsible for doing medical eligibility for a large portion of the department's medical eligibles. And we just wanted to touch that a little bit. The Division of Medical Assistance Programs will, of course, talk about their programs and program policies and proposals later in this process. The Children's, Adults, and Families eligibility area works closely with the Division of Medical Assistance Program in taking what are the program policies and then translating that into eligibility policies and processes. And there, within the Children's, Adults, and Families, there are about 420,000 eligibles that were served during 2006. If we turn now to page 68, I want to briefly touch on the policy packages that affect the self-sufficiency program area. And there are four policy packages here, three of which I really will defer for Division of Medical Assistance Programs to talk about. What's reflected here is the staffing impact for each of those policy packages. And so what I might do is just tell you what the staffing impact is so you have a reference to that. But beyond that, I think I would let that discussion go to another place. The first package is 101-6. That's the Healthy Kids Plan. And within self-sufficiency, we would add 16 positions at a cost of $0.9 million other funds, and that's tobacco tax. And the eligibility would be performed within the health plan processing center, essentially. The next policy package is the extension of the provider taxes for managed care organizations and hospitals. This would continue positions as the OHP standard program was continued. So that's what that does. The 103-36 expansion of OHP standard by 10,000 clients. Excuse me, I may not have mentioned the number of positions on the prior one. The 103-31 positions were 25, and that's actually on that chart that the 0.9 other funds actually should be 1 million. 103-36 would expand the OHP standard program by 10,000 clients, and as a result of that, the CAF would add 34 positions at a cost of $800,000 general fund. The last package, the 106-62 Self-Sufficiency Program Integrity Program, is a policy package that we are proposing so that we can take the efforts that we have applied to the food stamp program and begin to apply those to the other program areas. What this package would do is to make permanent the effort that has gone on in the food stamp program. The current effort has been funded from food stamp reinvestment funds that have the Food Nutrition Service has provided, and that money is one-time money and will end. And so that portion of the POP would fund five positions, and then we would add other positions to this as part of this policy package to begin those same sorts of efforts within the medical, TANF, and child care areas. And for that portion, we would add an additional 13 positions. So if I did that right, it should come to 18 positions. As a result of this effort, we're estimating that we would have across the department a net savings of $2.6 million general fund. The CAF cost for this policy package is $900,000 general fund. But as an overall department outcome, we expect that there would be a savings of $2.6 million in general fund.
That's a
yay. Questions? How long ago did we switch to doing all the eligibility in the field from the state processing, and what percentage of OHP applications are we now doing through the field offices?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, to check my recollection on that. My guess was going to be fiscal year 04, and the program manager just told me July of 04 is when we began that. In terms of the percentage, I don't know the percentage of applications. Approximately 70% of them out in the field.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know in many parts of the state that a client can come in and get eligibility handled for a lot of different programs, and I'd like to get kind of an idea how far along we are in this. Can a client come in and see one worker and find out they're qualified for food stamps, ERDC, or the health plan, TANF, jobs program? Can they get that in one site for most of the time, or are they still at times spread going to different places trying to figure this thing out?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, I think it's a mix across the state in terms of, and depending upon the program mix that the person may be coming in and needing in terms of whether they are getting all that service in one location, or if they are working with a partner or working in a different location, and it might be him.
Well, I was going to answer a little differently, Chair Carter and Senator Bates, because I think if you come into the office and you're applying for self-sufficiency services, whatever those are, your application is going to include that whole conversation about the package, the things you were describing on self-sufficiency. It'd be different if you were coming in and you also had a senior in the home and you're trying to apply for seniors and people with disability services. That might require you having another office to visit. Again, when we meet on the 28th, we're going to talk a little bit about what that array looks like now, because we have more offices now than we had several years ago where you actually can access those services in one place. But the eligibility, the idea behind the eligibility for TANF, if you're applying for that, is you would also know if you're eligible for Medicaid and if you're eligible for employment-related daycare and food stamps at the same time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So with that, we would move to the refugee program on page 71. The refugee program provides services to individuals that are fleeing persecution in their country of origin, and as determined by the Department of State, that status is established. In Oregon, we rank about approximately 14th in the nation in terms of the numbers of people who are placed across the country. We place about 1,100 people in Oregon a year, and that rate has been fairly steady for the last several years. And this particular program is 100% federal funds, and a large portion of the refugees do settle in the Portland area.
Madam Chair,
I'm Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. Oregon currently ranks 14th, so that's an absolute number of persons. How would we rank per capita compared to other states?
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, I would suspect we would be very, very high on the list on a per capita basis.
That's what it looks like. Thank you.
There are no policy packages for this particular program and no reductions, and so I was going to move to the prevention, program prevention category next.
Gordon, before you do that, I don't have a question, but I think it is worth noting on the record, if you will, the information about the award that ERCO received, the International Refugee Center of Oregon. Would you talk about that? That's highly significant.
Chair Carter, Senator Gordon, Mark Anderson will be joining me to talk about that.
Okay.
I didn't mention that since that had happened a couple years ago.
Well, for the record, I am Mark Anderson, refugee program coordinator for the state of Oregon. Not to be confused with the other fellow that was the child care program manager. Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, called ERCO, is a program that has been in existence since we first started receiving Vietnam refugees back in the 70s. And they work with refugees from all different cultures and are the ones that we use primarily for the employment program portion of the refugee program. And they have, over the years, have developed excellent relationship with employers. And that was a recognition of the importance of both the refugee program to the state of Oregon and the part that ERCO played in diversifying the workforce and working with refugees to become productive citizens. I don't know a whole lot about the organization that gave them that award. What impressed me was that the ties with the business community that ERCO has, which has been invaluable in terms of working with refugees.
Mm-hmm. The award came from the United States Department of Labor. I'm familiar with ERCO. It's an organization that sits in my district, and just remarkable, remarkable program, remarkable people serving African immigrants, Russian immigrants, folks from Southeast Asia, Latino, as you said, the world is represented at ERCO. And I did want to get this information onto the record, just acknowledging who they are and the good work that goes forward there every day.
Yes,
and appreciate your role in it as well. Thank you.
Thank you. So now we move to page 79 and just talk a little bit about the prevention program areas. There are really two main areas here, and that is the teen pregnancy prevention and the family support and connections program, which we've talked a little bit about in the last couple of days. The pregnancy prevention services are provided in conjunction with local health departments and school districts. And in 2006, with the STARS program, there were 400 schools across the state that participated in that, and there were 25,000 kids, young adults, who were served with that program using a little over 2,000 teen leaders. And so that program has had a lot of impact, a lot of success, but there's still a lot of work to do in that arena in terms of expanding the role. The Family Support and Connections Program is really a program that focuses on TANF families that are at high risk of needing child welfare services. And that program, as I mentioned, is fully funded and actually expanded somewhat in the governor's budget as part of the TANF reauthorization package. And that is the only policy package associated with this area. Chair Carter, to my surprise, we are actually early.
Wow. Representative
Kirchner. I was wondering if we could get a little history on the Community Safety Net, because I know that Family Supporting Connections was formerly Community Safety Net. My understanding was that when we had funded Community Safety Net, which we defunded last couple of biennium, I believe, that was if a family, I thought, connected with the child abuse hotline, for example, and they didn't rise to the level of needing connection with child protective services, but they were clearly a family in crisis, then they were referred out to the community for services. This takes a much narrower focus, working with preventing children from entering TANF children, smaller population, from going into foster care. I think a very good idea, but we've lost some of the broader prevention that Community Safety Net was providing, and I'm just wondering if we could talk a little bit about that and how do we get back to providing some of those broader services for families who aren't even connected with TANF.
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, I recall that when I first came here, we didn't have the safety net. And one of the things we've struggled with was the funding was never enough for all the families that might need to access something called safety net. And you're right, the prevailing criteria had to do with a family who became called in to the child abuse hotline, but it didn't rise to the standard of being a substantiated case, but yet there was need there. And as we've worked with that, we've worked closely with the Commission on Children and Families around this as well. How could we best use the amount of money we have? Because it wasn't a huge amount of money, but we certainly needed to focus it so that we can come back and report what are the outcomes. What happens when people get referred, when they go to these other services? Can we actually then impact how many families go deeper into the child welfare system? And that was
some of the decision making around the committee. There's a committee, a state steering committee, that chairs this particular program. And the idea was, if we identified families who are known to TANF and they get called in as child abuse and neglect potential abuse cases, then is there a way to make sure they get some services into that family that they could access, so that instead of having a substantiated case later, they might actually be able to keep the children in the home, keep the children safe. So it really was more around the fact we had X amount of resource and wanted to make sure we were covering as many people as we still could and still trace some outcomes about that. And I think Dave can talk a little bit about how we're looking at those outcomes at this point.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Leiter. I'm the TANF program manager and also have oversight over the Family Support and Connections area. We're looking at, as we kind of covered in the TANF section, a measure that looks at the number of children that enter the foster care system within 2 months of receiving TANF assistance, and trying to make that number go down in the aggregate. And so kind of just focusing in on that population, looking for those folks most at risk of needing those services, making referrals, improving that intake of those referral services trying to impact that rate.
Can I follow up? I think my confusion has been, and maybe it's just how I'm looking at it, but perhaps I should think of this as an augmented case management for those families, because as we know, a lot of the reasons a child might go into foster care is you have abuse, you have substance abuse in the home, or you have some very serious financial issues going on. We know those are leading indicators for abuse and neglect. I would assume if a family is connected with TANF, they're getting wraparound services already to keep them stable. And so this seems like it's an add-on to that for maybe higher-risk families, because I'm assuming that some of the greater assessment we're going to do redesign, those families will get more services. But maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, or?
Chair Carter, representing COTEC, obviously this is a complex area. A lot of, or a fair number of the families that are on TANF cash assistance are no-parent families, where the child actually is in foster care, or is living with grandparents or other relatives, and that is a means to keep them from ending up in that, in the foster care system. And so some of this is also working with those families, in addition to, kind of the traditional TANF family where there is an adult in the family.
Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, I would say that what we've done is we've narrowed a funnel here, because of all the families that potentially get referred. Remember that out of 60,000 reports a year, we will end up with about 30,000 families who go through some type of screening or assessment, and only about a third of those families end up with a substantiated case. That means an awful lot of families that get reported to the system where we don't have a substantiated case, but there is an identified need. And what we've tried to do is say, as you look at that funnel, where might we invest this amount of money to try to get access to additional services? You're right. One would hope that a TANF family would be able to access all of these services anyway. And what we find is often the kind of calls that come in where people are seeking help might not be a service that's readily available to a family. I can recall a lot of these situations that come in are around young people in the home, an incorrigible teen. We get a lot of calls from parents saying, I need help. Who can you refer me to? And a family like that might be referred. And we also don't dictate that you can only serve a family who was known to TANF. As I recall, Dave, what we've said is that should be a priority for serving families. But in some of the smaller communities, there may be other families who are at risk of intervention by child welfare, and they get referred to this particular service. But it's a fairly small population. It says here that we had 2,300 families referred last year. And so when you compare that to the 60,000 reports of abuse or neglect, it's fairly small.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah. Senator Morris.
Thank you. Thank you for asking that question. When I was mayor of Springfield, we had a terrible death. Tesla Nicole was a 3-year-old who was murdered by her by the mother's boyfriend, and I sat through the trial. He was given, the perpetrator was given the death sentence. I sat with the grandparents through that trial. There was a call to services to children and families, and it did not meet the criteria, so nothing was done. That prompted partly the need and the attention to the safety net system. And I recently met, well, it wasn't recently, but about 6 months ago, I met with some of the safety net proponents in Springfield, and the questions were asked, and I really appreciate that you asked this question. So I am going to reconnect with my Springfield contacts, and I will come back and talk with you specifically about the situation, the funding, what's available for the various communities, because the numbers may be low, but there are some very important numbers in there, individual cases and so on, and I don't want to see that program go away. It doesn't necessarily, it's not, I don't know if that person was connected with CANF, and that was a call to the agency. It didn't meet the criteria, so it was not checked out. And the safety net system might have checked that out and contacted the police. Or there are all kinds of possible results that could have developed from it. So I'll get back with you after I get more information. Thank you.
Thank you. And Chair Carter, Senator Morris, that'll be a nice segue, because on Monday when we start talking about Child Protective Services, I will be covering those kinds of issues about what kinds of calls come in and what actually does get responded to, what doesn't. We can always circle back and include in that a little bit of this discussion about how a family might be referred here versus having an assessment.
Yeah. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Thank you for a great committee and great presentation today.
Thank you, Chair.
Any questions or comments? Thank you.